Hello, you're listening to Science Digest. I'm Lynn Spears, a volunteer reading for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I'm reading articles from Nautilus Magazine, the 2026 issue, number 65. The first article I'll be reading today is called Lifetime of Friendships Slows Aging by Tyler Santora. Good friends aren't just good for their shoulder to lean on in tough times. Studies have shown for at least 40 years that having social support can protect against heart disease, cognitive decline, and even death. But new research suggests it's not just about having friends in the moment. The depth and consistency of a person's relationships over a lifetime have a huge impact on their health and is even written in their DNA. For the new study, researchers compared social experiences across the lifespan of more than 2,100 middle-aged adults in the United States to the biological clock embedded in their DNA. The hands of these biological clocks consist of epigenetic changes to DNA, specifically patterns in the addition of a chemical called a methyl group to certain genes. Such methylation doesn't cause mutation. Rather, the process turns the gene on or off in different cells of the body at different times. Over time, methylation patterns on certain genes change and can be used as markers of biological aging, a measure of how rapidly cells wear down that can be faster or slower than aging by the calendar. An older biological age is a stronger predictor of chronic disease and early death. The researchers measured social connection in a variety of settings over time to show that people with more social activity and sincere long-lasting relationships aged more slowly. We found that the depth and consistency of social connection built across decades in different areas of life matters profoundly, says Anthony Ong, a psychologist at Cornell University. Strong and sustained social networks appear to actually set back a person's biological clock. Ong's team also reported that people with less social connection had higher levels of an inflammatory molecule that promotes heart disease, diabetes, and neurodegeneration. One strength of the new study is that it considered lifelong social connection in a holistic way, says Courtney Bowen, a sociologist at Brown University who is not involved in the study. Most researchers who analyze the health effects of social connections look at more specific and short-term measures, Bowen says, such as how many friends they have or whether they feel supported by their local community. But Ong's team captures a bigger picture by looking at social ties experienced in four domains: family relationships in childhood, religious life, emotional support, and community engagement. They measured this by asking subjects questions like, how much affection did your mother give you? How often did you seek comfort through religious or spiritual means? How often do you receive emotional support from friends and family? And do you believe that people are kind? The researchers didn't break down how each of these domains might be linked to biological aging individually. I'd like to see all these separately, says Kathleen Mullen-Harris, a sociologist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who was not involved in the study. For example, Harris says she doubts that DNA methylation, affected by parental relationships in childhood, still has a large direct impact on biological age in adulthood. Rather, she thinks it's more important how those relationships prime people to connect with others later in life. Still, the study clearly suggests that social connection, viewed holistically, is linked to a younger biological clock. To stay connected, Harris recommends joining institutions that already exist in your community. This could include a wide variety of groups like schools, religious organizations, volunteer clubs, or sports teams. Bowen recommends focusing on quality over quantity when choosing who to make friends with and which friendships to invest in. Superficial ties tend to matter less than deeper ties, she says. It's not just the number of people that you are connected to, but how close you are to them that really matters. Carving out space for meaningful social connection can be difficult in a world where responsibilities and distractions compete for precious free time, but it may be worth thinking about in a new way. Social connections are a lifelong investment for profound physical health benefits, Ong says. Aging well isn't only about staying physically healthy. It's also fundamentally about staying connected. Our second story is called When We Were Lunch, How Being Food for Other Animals Has Made Us Into the Humans We Are Today by David P. Barash. Alone in a canoe, Val Plumwood was gliding along a channel in tropical Australia's Kakadu National Park in 1985 when a huge crocodile rammed her. She paddled to the shore as fast as she could, but the crocodile struck the canoe again and again. A thought flashed through Plumwood's mind. I am prey. She grabbed hold of an overhanging tree, hoping to escape onto land. Before my foot even tripped the first branch, I had a blurred, incredulous vision of great toothed jaws bursting from the water, Plumwood wrote. Then I was seized between the legs in a red-hot pincher grip and whirled into the suffocating wet darkness. The crocodile rolled, Plumwood underwater, trying to drown her. The roll was a centrifuge of boiling blackness that lasted for an eternity, beyond endurance. But when I seemed all but finished, the rolling suddenly stopped. My feet touched bottom, my head broke the surface, and coughing, I sucked at air, amazed to be alive. The crocodile still had me in its pincher grip between the legs. I had just begun to weep for the prospects of my mangled body when the crocodile pitched me suddenly into a second death roll. Plumwood surfaced only to be dunked for the third time by the crocodile, but when the croc rolled her above the water yet again, he briefly loosened his jaws, and she managed to scramble to a muddy bank and claw her way up it. After hours of painful struggle through the bush, a park ranger heard her cries for help, and remarkably, she was rescued. Plumwood was an eco-philosopher, deeply attuned to the connectedness of human beings with the natural world. Her survival allowed her to give the rest of us one of the most riveting accounts of what it means to be prey. I glimpsed a shockingly indifferent world in which I had no more significance than any other edible being, Plumwood wrote. The thought, this can't be happening to me, I'm a human being, I am more than just food, was one component of my terminal incredulity. It was a shocking reduction from a complex human being to a mere piece of meat. We may not think about being prey today because humans are the most successful predator on Earth, except for those occasional times when we've been taken down by a grizzly bear, lion, hyena, crocodile, or python. Yes, python. As recently as 2024, an Indonesian farmer reported missing the day before was exhumed from inside a 16-foot python. After killing their victims by suffocation, these huge constrictors can dislocate their jaws and swallow a person whole, even if that prey is larger than the reptile's head. But hominins, which includes us, have been prey for most of our existence, dating from when we broke from other primates 7 million years ago, a troubled predator-prey relationship that didn't end just because we became human. Being the hunted has left a deep impact on our personal and collective memories, with imprints that have, in the language of evolutionary biology, been conserved not only in modern mythology, but possibly in our genomes as well. It likely drove our ability to control fire, develop ever more deadly tools, find security in social groups, even walk upright and speak. It also has its downsides. Our innate sense of fear, compounded by stress, which can waylay our bodies and brains, likely evolved from us being mere pieces of meat. It wasn't always thus. In the Animals of Human Evolution research, a drive to kill other animals as well as each other was considered key to our past and present. Man the hunter and even man the murderous cannibal were ascendant evolutionary tropes when it came to hypothesizing about our earliest inclinations in popular as well as scholarly thought. This perspective was largely initiated by the South African anthropologist Raymond Dart, famous for having discovered a species of Australopithecus, which lived 3 million to 2 million years ago. Dart's hyperventilating insistence on our murderous, war-prone prehistoric inclinations was reflected in such influential writing as The Predatory Transition from Ape to Man in 1953, and which inspired popular and grossly misleading books such as Robert Audrey's African Genesis in 1977. Dart also discovered an A. africana skull designated the Tong child who died at age 3 or 4. Dart dramatically proclaimed the child to have been an early victim of human murder and cannibalism. Subsequent analysis by anthropologist Lee Berger in 2006 revealed that the skull showed talon marks around the eye sockets, as well as indentations on the base of the skull consistent with injuries incurred by non-human primates who are carried off and eaten by eagles or other large predatory birds. Nevertheless, the perspective of our ancestors being vicious predators instead of victims, was enthusiastically adopted, in part because it was consistent, As Washington University's anthropologist Robert Sussman argues, with a basic Judeo-Christian ideology of man being inherently evil, aggressive, and a natural killer, Sussman points out that to some degree it still dominates such thought by the public as well as professionals. Of late, however, the scientific balance has been shifting, partly inspired by the 2005 book Man the Hunted, in which Sussman and anthropologist Donna Hart point out that most primates are prey rather than predators, a pattern seen in A. Africanus like Lucy and her descendants. Sussman and Hart noted that A. Africanus was an edge species, inhabiting borderlines between trees and savannas, likely reverting to the former to sleep and to escape from huge ground-dwelling predators, which were roughly 10 times more abundant than they are today. These included cave lions, dire wolves, and hyenas as big as bears, and bears as enormous as North American short-faced bears, which stood 11 feet tall on their hind legs. Tree-climbing abilities would have likely have been key to survival in such a tough neighborhood. Moreover, recent fossils have been suggestive that our ancestors were on the menu for animals, although, as with nearly all such data, the sample sizes are small. There is OH8, a Homo habilis species dated at 1.8 million years old, discovered by the Leakeys in Olduvio Gorge, Tanzania, and whose left foot and detached legs show extensive tooth marks from a crocodile. Plumwood's experience, it appears, wasn't unique. Ditto for another victim, labeled OH35, who was evidently dismembered by one or more crocs, and whose other skeletal parts have been chewed by a leopard-sized carnivore. It's also possible, of course, that these early meals involve scavenging on carrion rather than killing the live prey. In 2025, scientists from the Institute of Evolution in Africa, Rice University, and the Archaeological and Paleontological Museum of Madrid published computer analyses of Homo habilis fossils OH7 and OH65 that showed with unprecedented reliability that our ancestors of 2 million to 1.5 million years ago were food for leopards. The authors argue the new finding is significant because Homo habilis, who made stone tools and ate meat, has long been regarded as the turning point from prey to predator in our evolutionary history. In fact, they write, Homo habilis was still more prey than predator and unable to fend off top predators from their kills. Where does this leave us today, experiencing our own predator-free lives? We're a peculiar species, in our anatomy, no less than our intellectual accomplishments. Paleoanthropologists have been at pains to figure out how some of our notable traits evolved. Rebranding ourselves as hunted rather than exclusively hunter can help explain those key traits. Take the upright posture. Standing on two vertical pillars while nervously scanning the horizon would have given prehumans a literal leg up when it came to providing an early warning system. After all, it wasn't just leopards and those saber-toothed tigers that stalked our early environments, but also direwolves and a whole slew of other fearsome potential perps. Of course, standing upright might have made us more visible to those dangerous predators, but it also could have provided an opportunity to intimidate them. Even today, hikers who encounter a cougar are advised to make themselves as big as possible, to stand up tall, wave their arms, and shout. Did the savannah ring with yells of our terrestrial antecedents? Then there are tools. It used to be thought that those much-lauded big brains of ours were a prerequisite for using, and more so, making them. No longer. In the 1960s, Jane Goodall made the pioneering discovery that chimps not only use sticks to fish for termites, but they first smooth them by stripping away any twigs and leaves. Fossil evidence shows that stone tools were constructed and employed as long ago as 3.3 million years, when ancestral hominid brains weren't particularly impressive. It's clear that our forebears were not only stone chippers, but also makers of obsidian-tipped javelins around 280,000 years ago, as well as being likely stick sharpeners, the latter first appearing around 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. Apparently whittled by early Neanderthals and Homo heidelbergensis, tools and weapons certainly helped our predecessors fill their bellies and maybe defend against other hominids. But what about also defending themselves to keep from filling the bellies of their predators? Once we consider the likely impact of being preyed upon by other creatures, no less than preying upon them, many other fundamental human traits take on new meaning.
You're listening to Science Digest. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Early communications by gesture and words, quite likely helpful when it came to group cohesion, sharing information as to food sources along with water holes during drought, achieving social dominance, and the like. Oxford University's Robin Dunbar has made the case that speech originated as cohesion-generating social gossip. But don't ignore the playoff of being able to broadcast a prompt heads up when a predator appears. Today, many animal species, from birds to primates, use remarkably precise alarm calls to warn of danger. Vervet monkeys employ three different kinds, each predator-specific, one for snakes, the monkey can look down, one for eagles, up, and one for big cats, clamber into trees. Would early humans have been less vocally accomplished? Is it unreasonable to hypothesize that predator warning calls were among the first verbalisms used by our hominid ancestors? Imagine yourself back in those early days. What would you consider more important, sharing a bit of gossip or being warned that a saber-toothed cat is around the corner? And consider fire. Undoubtedly beneficial when it comes to cooking our own food, making tough carbohydrate-based plant matter, as well as animal protein more digestible, nutritional payoffs that, as anthropologist Richard Wrangham has proposed, may also have set the stage for a rapid brain development. Imagine our great-great Homo erectus grandparent sitting cozily around a mid-Pliocene fire roughly 1 million years ago, cooking dinner and swapping lies. Isn't it likely that one thing that made those fires so cozy is that they probably kept predators away? Even our lauded intelligence and cooperative sociality, which doubtless evolved for many different reasons, would also have been more trivially useful for hominids and hominids when it came to outsmarting or at least surviving our hungry natural predators. Quick note, hominid refers to any member of the great apes, gibbons, orangutans, chimps, gorillas, and humans, as well as their fossil ancestors, while hominin refers more narrowly to species in the direct human line. So all hominins are hominids, but not vice versa. Like most of our primate relatives, human beings with their receding jaws, laughably blunt teeth, and soft bodies are ill-equipped to defend themselves bodily. Here's where sociality pays off. A consistent pattern is that relatively defenseless animals are especially likely to live in groups, which facilitates collective defense, as well as providing more eyes, ears, and noses to detect danger and sometimes to visually confuse predators when numerous potential victims suddenly disperse. Notably, every species of diurnal terrestrial primate is group living. That includes us. Some years ago, I was hiking solo in the North Cascades of Washington State when I was surprised to see an odd-looking mammal, strangely flattened horizontally and walking in the snow with a curious rolling motion. A wolverine. It was the first and only time I've seen one in the wild. To my subsequent embarrassment, rather than reach for my camera, I reached for my ice axe. Granted that wolverines are known pound for pound to be among the most ferocious mammals, allegedly sometimes challenging grizzlies off a carcass, but they rarely weigh more than 30 pounds and have never been known to attack a human being. What possessed me? John Byers, a professor of biology at the University of Idaho, spent decades studying pronghorns, the fastest terrestrial creatures in North America. Noting there currently aren't any super-fast predators in North America, Byers hypothesized in his book, Built for Speed, that the dazzling velocity of these animals, incidentally, they're not really antelopes, but a kind of goat, is due to them being hunted by the ghosts of predators past. Now extinct dire wolves and oversized cats. We're similarly haunted, which probably explains why a trained biologist gave in to the momentary sense that I was somehow at risk, haunted by the ghosts of predators past. The impulse to fight or flee is deeply ingrained in our biology by the way of a response system involving the amygdala, the brain's fear center, and the hypothalamus, which, among other things, encodes memories of other fear-inducing events, providing context as to whether a current situation warrants special attention. And there's our crucial adrenal cortex axis, a neurodoctrine feedback loop that leads to the release of cortisol, a highly adaptive response to stress. Neurobiologist and primatologist Robert Sapolsky has been especially effective in pointing out that stress is the body's natural response to predators. Stress is designed to save your neck in hairy situations by channeling all the energy in your body to fighting or fleeing, Sapolsky has told Nautilus. That's awfully important when somebody is very intent to eat you. The problem is predator-free modern humans trigger stress in themselves. That's the distinctive thing that does us in. That's not what stress evolved for, Sapolsky said. It evolved for dealing with a short-term crisis. Yet we turn it on for 30-year mortgages. That's where you pay the price. There's virtually no organ system in your body that's not thrown out of kilter in some way by chronic psychological stress. Ultimately, we can take a healthy lesson from our evolutionary history as prey. Plumwood, who died of a stroke in 2008, wrote that her crocodile encounter italicized for her the reality that she was very much a part of a shared world. It is a humbling and cautionary tale about our relationship with the earth, about the need to acknowledge our own animality and ecological vulnerability, Plumwood wrote. The assumption that animals can be our food, but we can never be theirs, has disconnected us from the world in which we evolved and continue to inhabit together. We are animals positioned in the food chain, sometimes on top, sometimes not, eater as well as eaten.
Our last reading today is called The Fractals of Jackson Pollock by Kristen French. Jackson Pollock's paintings look like beautiful accidents. The 20th century painter spilled, drizzled, and flung paint from brushes, cans, syringes, and sticks at canvases laid out on the floor in seemingly haphazard and unchoreographed fashion. But while art lovers admire the work, scientists have long aimed to understand the laws that govern them, in part to devise tools that could help distinguish his paintings from imitations. Recently, one team of researchers set out to see whether his process was closer to how children or adults might paint. To answer that question, they asked a group of adults aged 18 to 25 and children aged 4 to 6 to make paintings in the style of Pollock by pouring paint onto canvases. The researchers found that the kids' paintings made in this manner resembled genuine Pollocks more than did those from adult painters. They published their results in Frontiers in Physics. To arrive at this conclusion, the scientists used two forms of statistical analysis, fractal analysis and lunacarity. Whereas fractal analysis measures complexity, lunacarity reveals something more subtle, the rhythm and space in a complex network. Measuring lunacarity has helped scientists understand natural systems such as galaxies in the universe. The researchers found that the children's art, and to some extent Pollock's, featured lower fractal dimensions and higher lunacarity than the adult assays. The force with which Pollock flung his paints caused them to follow a pattern known in physics as a fluid mechanical sewing machine. Yes, that's a real technical term, because the coils moved sideways in an orderly fashion as they contacted the surface, resembling sewing patterns. Pollock must have intentionally moved his hand at certain speeds and heights and selected specific paints to prevent his colors from fragmenting before hitting the canvas. Whether measuring balance, fractals, or fluid dynamics, scientists continue to search for order in Pollock's frenzied creative process. But whether his method was one of calculated chaos or creative madness, the mathematics say it worked. You've been listening to Science Digest with readings from Nautilus Magazine. I'm Lynn Spears, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. I hope you enjoyed today's show, and I hope you come back again next week. As always, thank you for listening.